With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got all the essentials for comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style you can count on. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and effortless looks. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25.
With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got you covered with comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting, confident looks you can count on. For over a decade, Mack Weldon has designed timeless, innovative menswear to help you move through the day with confidence. With the new Ace line, looking effortlessly sophisticated this fall is easy and comfortable. Stock up on crazy cozy sweatpants, shorts, and sweatshirts that elevate your style. They even have blazers, if you're lucky enough to grab one while they're in stock. Mack Weldon balances classic pieces with updated details to keep you looking sharp. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made with the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace Collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code MACK25.
David Hume, a stout, rosy-cheeked old man, lies propped up in bed, greeting his visitor with a gentle smile. It is the summer of 1776 in Edinburgh, and David Hume knows he is dying. Yet there is no fear in his clear gray eyes, only mild amusement at the anxious expression on young James Boswell's face. Boswell has come to see whether the great skeptic is frightened to meet his maker at last. But Hume, ever composed, chuckles softly. He spins an imaginary tale for Boswell. Perhaps, he says, he might bargain with Charon, the ferryman of Hades, to grant him a few more years of life. Boswell is perplexed. Hume is making light of the very death that so terrifies others. The philosopher assures his visitor that he departs life as he lived it, in calm reason and good humor, without dread of hellfire. It is a scene that will be whispered about in drawing rooms across Britain, a famous infidel meeting his end more serenely than many a devout man. To understand how David Hume achieved such equanimity, one must look back over the remarkable course of his life. He was born in 1711, the second son of a minor Scottish laird in the border county of Berwickshire. His childhood home, Ninewells, perched by the River Whiteadder amid green rolling hills. David was a precocious lad, curious and wide-eyed. After his father died when David was only two, his mother, herself intellectually inclined, saw to it that her son received a solid education. At just 11 years old, the boy enrolled at the University of Edinburgh. There, amid the echoing lecture halls, he delved into classical literature, philosophy, and science. Hume was slight and soft-spoken, but possessed an immense appetite for learning. By his late teens, he had quietly resolved to make a name for himself as a philosopher. That ambition soon consumed him wholly. In 1734, at age 23, David Hume found himself living alone in La Flèche, a sleepy town in France's Loire Valley. He had gone there to seclude himself and work on an enormous philosophical treatise that he envisioned would revolutionize human understanding. He read and wrote for 10, 12, 15 hours a day, pushing his mind to its limits. The strain nearly broke him. He later admitted that during this period, he fell into a deep melancholy, a modern reader might say depression, brought on by intense study and isolation. Hume eventually realized he needed a more moderate regimen to recover his health. He started taking long walks under the French chestnut trees, chatting with locals at the inn, allowing himself the pleasures of company and wine. Slowly, his cheerfulness returned. From this youthful crisis, Hume learned a valuable lesson. Philosophy should never be pursued at the expense of one's humanity and happiness. It took Hume several years to craft the work he had poured his soul into. In 1739, at last, his masterwork emerged in print, A Treatise of Human Nature, 3 volumes of bold, original ideas on the mind, knowledge, and emotions. Hume published it anonymously, as was common. He eagerly awaited the public's reception. It was a disaster. The treatise, in Hume's own rueful words, fell dead-born from the press. The learned world scarcely noticed this provincial Scot's groundbreaking ideas. It was a bitter disappointment. In the treatise, Hume had set out to apply the experimental method of science to the study of human nature. He argued that all our ideas derive from sensory experiences, and that reason is the slave of the passions. He even challenged the notion of a consistent self, suggesting that the self is just a bundle of perceptions that come and go. These were radical, unsettling claims, yet hardly anyone bothered to read them. Hume did not give up. Licking his wounds, he returned to Scotland and set about recasting his ideas in a more accessible form. In the 1740s, he published his essays, Moral and Political, which this time found a much warmer reception. Hume's style in the essays was polished, witty, and clear, the opposite of the dense abstraction that had marred the treatise. At social clubs and coffeehouses from Edinburgh to London, gentlemen quoted his insightful lines on topics ranging from economics to aesthetics. With the success of the essays, Hume's reputation began to grow. He gained a circle of respected friends, among them the economist Adam Smith and the playwright John Home, with whom, despite the identical surname spelled differently, he joked he had a dialectical opposition. By his mid-30s, Hume had secured a modest sinecure as a librarian in Edinburgh. That position proved a springboard for one of his greatest accomplishments, the History of England. Using the vast resources of the library, Hume embarked on writing a multi-volume history spanning from ancient Roman times to the 1688 revolution. He worked meticulously, determined to make history engaging and impartial. The first volume appeared in 1754. At first, it too was attacked, this time by English readers who thought the Scottish author showed too much sympathy to the ousted Stuart kings. But subsequent volumes won over the public. Hume wrote with a graceful narrative flair uncommon in historians of his day. By the time he finished, The History of England had become a sensation and the main textbook of English history for decades. It made Hume the most famous historian in Britain and, ironically, brought him far more income and acclaim during his lifetime than his philosophical writings ever did. Despite the turn to history and essays, Hume never abandoned philosophy. In 1748, he published An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, a refined, clearer presentation of the main ideas from his early treatise. It was in this work that Hume quietly inserted a bombshell that would shake future philosophers to their core, the problem of induction. He gently pointed out that while we assume the future will resemble the past, that the sun will rise tomorrow because it always has, we have no rational proof of it, only habit. Likewise, he questioned our belief in causation itself. We never actually see a necessary connection between events, only one event following another. These skeptical insights would later famously awaken Immanuel Kant from his dogmatic slumbers and revolutionize philosophy. But in Hume's own time, their full import was not yet recognized. Hume's skepticism extended to religion, though he trod carefully in that arena to avoid persecution. Scotland in the 18th century was devoutly Presbyterian, and open atheism could spell social ruin. So Hume became a master of polite subtlety. In his Enquiry, he included a chapter quietly dismantling belief in miracles, arguing that it was always more likely that the testimony of a miracle worker was mistaken or lying than that a law of nature had been suspended. And in private, he penned Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, a philosophical conversation questioning the rational basis for believing in a divine designer of the universe. He held that manuscript in reserve, not allowing it to be published until after his death due to its controversial content. Even with his measured public statements, Hume gained a reputation as an unbeliever. In Edinburgh's social circles, ministers and moralists frowned at his presence, but his personal charm often disarmed them, for David Hume was by all accounts an exceedingly amiable man. Corpulent and ruddy, with a warm smile ever at the ready, he delighted in conversation and good company. Children and servants adored him for his kind manners. He was known to get down on the floor to play games with little ones during visits. In Paris, where he lived for a time in the 1760s as a diplomat, he became the toast of the town. The French philosophers, Diderot, D'Alembert, Voltaire, celebrated Le Bon David, Good David, for his wit and benevolence. Elegant society ladies fussed over him, and one even attempted to slim him down with a regimen of spa treatments and diets, which Hume dutifully underwent, though with little effect on his plump figure. Hume was amused by French high society and flattered by their affection, yet he remained a down-to-earth Scot at heart. The most notorious episode during Hume's time in Paris was his entanglement with Jean-Jacques Rousseau. In 1766, Hume extended his hospitality to Rousseau, who was fleeing persecution on the continent. At first, the two great thinkers admired each other. Hume secured a pension for Rousseau from the British crown and brought him to England for safety. But Rousseau's notorious paranoia soon soured the friendship. He came to believe, utterly without cause, that Hume was part of some conspiracy to harm or spy on him. Rousseau wrote a scurrilous public letter essentially accusing Hume of being a traitor and a fraud. Hume was stunned and deeply hurt. He tried to remain composed, but friends noted that this quarrel with Rousseau caused him more distress than perhaps anything else in his life. In the end, Hume broke off all contact with Rousseau and returned to Edinburgh, lamenting how even the wisest of men could be brought low by irrational suspicions. In his final years back in Edinburgh, Hume enjoyed a peaceful semi-retirement. He built a lovely home in the new town and named it, tongue-in-cheek, James's Court after himself, though it was really a humble apartment within a larger building. There he hosted intimate supper gatherings, delighting friends with lively discussions on everything from politics to the latest novels. One frequent guest was his close friend Adam Smith, author of The Wealth of Nations. The two of them would stroll the city's cobbled streets together, two balding bachelors discussing morals and markets, while twilight fell over the castle. Hume had become something of an elder statesman of letters, a revered figure in Scotland and beyond. When Hume was diagnosed with intestinal cancer in 1775, he faced the news with characteristic tranquility. He put his affairs in order, updated his will, making generous provisions for his family and servants, and even wrote a brief autobiography so candid and serene that one friend quipped it was the only cheerful piece of writing in that genre. As his health declined, visitors streamed to his bedside, among them the ever-curious James Boswell. Many came expecting, or perhaps hoping, to see fear or regret in the great skeptic at the end. Instead, they found Hume placid and even cheerful, joking about how death might be nothingness, a mere eternal rest, hardly something to dread. On an August day in 1776, David Hume passed away at age 65, attended by his doctor and a few friends. There was no deathbed conversion, no cries for mercy, just a quiet exit, as one might leave a pleasant gathering early because the hour grows late. Hume's funeral was simple. Yet even in death he caused a stir. Rumors spread that lightning struck the graveyard the night after his burial, which some took as divine judgment on the infidel, though it was likely apocryphal. His tombstone, at his request, carried only his name and dates with no pious epitaph. In the years and centuries that followed, Hume's ideas steadily gained the recognition they hadn't always received during his life. His philosophical skepticism became a foundation for modern empiricism and the scientific approach to understanding the mind. Immanuel Kant, arguably the central figure of modern philosophy, admitted that Hume interrupted my dogmatic slumber and drove him to develop his critical philosophy. In theology, Hume's arguments about miracles and the limits of human knowledge anticipated the secular, critical perspective that would blossom in the 19th and 20th centuries. And in the social sciences, Hume's insights into human psychology as a creature more governed by sentiment and habit than by pure reason prefigured modern psychology and economics, Adam Smith's theories of moral sentiments and market behavior were influenced by discussions with his friend Hume. Perhaps equally important is the personal legacy Hume left in How to Live a Good Life Grounded in Skepticism. He demonstrated by example that one could question religious and metaphysical certainties without falling into despair or nihilism. Hume's gentle, benevolent disposition was a rebuttal to those who claimed that without faith, a man must be wicked or despondent. Voltaire, upon hearing of Hume's peaceful death, remarked that the English had thought one couldn't be both a philosopher and a good person. But here is David Hume proving them wrong by his life and death. Today, David Hume is widely regarded as one of the greatest philosophers to write in English. His works remain staples in philosophy courses worldwide. Whenever scientists emphasize observation and experiment, they echo Hume. Whenever people debate whether reason or emotion drives human choices, they are walking the ground Hume cleared. He helped shift the center of philosophy from lofty speculation to the common human experience, from the heavens to the hearth, so to speak. In a churchyard in Edinburgh's Old Kelton Burial Ground stands a stout cylindrical tomb where Hume's remains lie. Visitors often leave pennies on it, a nod, perhaps, to his portrait once gracing Scotland's currency, or maybe to his empirical, down-to-earth philosophy. Standing there, one can reflect on the journey of the farmer's son, who became a celebrated man of letters and changed the course of thought. David Hume approached truth with a light heart and keen mind. He showed the world that skepticism need not be a source of terror, that one can question and doubt and still live fully and kindly. And in that final meeting with Boswell, he even showed how a life guided by reason and virtue can meet death with a smile. As Hume himself wrote in his autobiography, he was a man of mild dispositions, of command of temper, of an open, social, and cheerful humor, who sought truth in all things. In the end, he found truth enough in the tranquility of a life well-lived and a death well-met, leaving behind a legacy of wisdom tempered by humanity. David Hume, a stout, rosy-cheeked old man, lies propped up in bed, greeting his visitor with a gentle smile. It is the summer of 17...
Fall calls for comfort. Mack Weldon's got essentials designed for cool days and timeless style. Their new Ace line combines comfort with sophisticated looks. Go to MackWeldon.com for 20% off your first order of $125 or more with code MACK25.
76 in Edinburgh. And David Hume knows he is dying. Yet there is no fear in his clear gray eyes, only mild amusement at the anxious expression on young James Boswell's face. Boswell has come to see whether the great skeptic is frightened to meet his maker at last. But Hume, ever composed, chuckles softly. He spins an imaginary tale for Boswell. Perhaps, he says, he might bargain with Charon, the ferryman of Hades, to grant him a few more years of life. Boswell is perplexed. Hume is making light of the very death that so terrifies others. The philosopher assures his visitor that he departs life as he lived it, in calm reason and good humor, without dread of hellfire. It is a scene that will be whispered about in drawing rooms across Britain, a famous infidel meeting his end more serenely than many a devout man. To understand how David Hume achieved such equanimity, one must look back over the remarkable course of his life. He was born in 1711, the second son of a minor Scottish laird in the border county of Berwickshire. His childhood home, Ninewells, perched by the River White Adder amid green rolling hills. David was a precocious lad, curious and wide-eyed. After his father died when David was only two, his mother, herself intellectually inclined, saw to it that her son received a solid education. At just 11 years old, the boy enrolled at the University of Edinburgh. There, amid the echoing lecture halls, he delved into classical literature, philosophy, and science. Hume was slight and soft-spoken, but possessed an immense appetite for learning. By his late teens, he had quietly resolved to make a name for himself as a philosopher. That ambition soon consumed him wholly. In 1734, at age 23, David Hume found himself living alone in La Flèche, a sleepy town in France's Loire Valley. He had gone there to seclude himself and work on an enormous philosophical treatise that he envisioned would revolutionize human understanding. He read and wrote for 10, 12, 15 hours a day, pushing his mind to its limits. The strain nearly broke him. He later admitted that during this period, he fell into a deep melancholy. A modern reader might say depression, brought on by intense study and isolation. Hume eventually realized he needed a more moderate regimen to recover his health. He started taking long walks under the French chestnut trees, chatting with locals at the inn, allowing himself the pleasures of company and wine. Slowly, his cheerfulness returned. From this youthful crisis, Hume learned a valuable lesson. Philosophy should never be pursued at the expense of one's humanity and happiness. It took Hume several years to craft the work he had poured his soul into. In 1739, at last, his masterwork emerged in print, A Treatise of Human Nature, 3 volumes of bold, original ideas on the mind, knowledge, and emotions. Hume published it anonymously, as was common. He eagerly awaited the public's reception. It was a disaster. The treatise, in Hume's own rueful words, fell dead-born from the press. The learned world scarcely noticed this provincial Scot's groundbreaking ideas. It was a bitter disappointment. In the treatise, Hume had set out to apply the experimental method of science to the study of human nature. He argued that all our ideas derive from sensory experiences and that reason is the slave of the passions. He even challenged the notion of a consistent self, suggesting that the self is just a bundle of perceptions that come and go. These were radical, unsettling claims, yet hardly anyone bothered to read them. Hume did not give up. Licking his wounds, he returned to Scotland and set about recasting his ideas in a more accessible form. In the 1740s, he published his essays, Moral and Political, which this time found a much warmer reception. Hume's style in the essays was polished, witty, and clear, the opposite of the dense abstraction that had marred the treatise. At social clubs and coffee houses from Edinburgh to London, gentlemen quoted his insightful lines on topics ranging from economics to aesthetics. With the success of the essays, Hume's reputation began to grow. He gained a circle of respected friends, among them the economist Adam Smith and the playwright John Home, with whom, despite the identical surname spelled differently, he joked he had a dialectical opposition. By his mid-30s, Hume had secured a modest sinecure as a librarian in Edinburgh. That position proved a springboard for one of his greatest accomplishments, The History of England. Using the vast resources of the library, Hume embarked on writing a multi-volume history spanning from ancient Roman times to the 1688 Revolution. He worked meticulously, determined to make history engaging and impartial. The first volume appeared in 1754. At first, it too was attacked, this time by English readers who thought the Scottish author showed too much sympathy to the ousted Stuart kings. But subsequent volumes won over the public. Hume wrote with a graceful narrative flair uncommon in historians of his day. By the time he finished, The History of England had become a sensation and the main textbook of English history for decades. It made Hume the most famous historian in Britain, and ironically, brought him far more income and acclaim during his lifetime than his philosophical writings ever did. Despite the turn to history and essays, Hume never abandoned philosophy. In 1748, he published An Enquiry Concerning Human Understanding, a refined, clearer presentation of the main ideas from his early treatise. It was in this work that Hume quietly inserted a bombshell that would shake future philosophers to their core, the problem of induction. He gently pointed out that while we assume the future will resemble the past, that the sun will rise tomorrow because it always has, we have no rational proof of it, only habit. Likewise, he questioned our belief in causation itself. We never actually see a necessary connection between events, only one event following another. These skeptical insights would later famously awaken Immanuel Kant from his dogmatic slumbers and revolutionize philosophy. But in Hume's own time, their full import was not yet recognized. Hume's skepticism extended to religion, though he trod carefully in that arena to avoid persecution. Scotland in the 18th century was devoutly Presbyterian, and open atheism could spell social ruin. so Hume became a master of polite subtlety. In his inquiry, he included a chapter quietly dismantling belief in miracles, arguing that it was always more likely that the testimony of a miracle worker was mistaken or lying than that a law of nature had been suspended. And in private, he penned Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, a philosophical conversation questioning the rational basis for believing in a divine designer of the universe. He held that manuscript in reserve, not allowing it to be published until after his death due to its controversial content. Even with his measured public statements, Hume gained a reputation as an unbeliever. In Edinburgh's social circles, ministers and moralists frowned at his presence, but his personal charm often disarmed them, for David Hume was, by all accounts, an exceedingly amiable man. Corpulent and ruddy, with a warm smile ever at the ready, he delighted in conversation and good company. Children and servants adored him for his kind manners. He was known to get down on the floor to play games with little ones during visits. In Paris, where he lived for a time in the 1760s as a diplomat, he became the toast of the town. The French philosophers, Diderot, D'Holbach, Voltaire, celebrated Le Bon David, Good David, for his wit and benevolence. Elegant society ladies fussed over him, and one even attempted to slim him down with a regimen of spa treatments and diets, which Hume dutifully underwent, though with little effect on his plump figure. Hume was amused by French high society and flattered by their affection, yet he remained a down-to-earth Scot at heart. The most notorious episode during Hume's time in Paris was his entanglement with Jean-Jacques Rousseau. In 1766, Hume extended his hospitality to Rousseau, who was fleeing persecution on the continent. At first, the two great thinkers admired each other. Hume secured a pension for Rousseau from the British crown and brought him to England for safety. But Rousseau's notorious paranoia soon soured the friendship. He came to believe, utterly without cause, that Hume was part of some conspiracy to harm or spy on him. Rousseau wrote a scurrilous public letter essentially accusing Hume of being a traitor and a fraud. Hume was stunned and deeply hurt. He tried to remain composed, but friends noted that this quarrel with Rousseau caused him more distress than perhaps anything else in his life. In the end, Hume broke off all contact with Rousseau and returned to Edinburgh, lamenting how even the wisest of men could be brought low by irrational suspicions. In his final years back in Edinburgh, Hume enjoyed a peaceful semi-retirement. He built a lovely home in the new town and named it, tongue-in-cheek, James's Court, after himself, though it was really a humble apartment within a larger building. There he hosted intimate supper gatherings, delighting friends with lively discussions on everything from politics to the latest novels. One frequent guest was his close friend Adam Smith, author of The Wealth of Nations. The two of them would stroll the city's cobbled streets together, two balding bachelors discussing morals and markets while twilight fell over the castle. Hume had become something of an elder statesman of letters, a revered figure in Scotland and beyond. When Hume was diagnosed with intestinal cancer in 1775, he faced the news with characteristic tranquility. He put his affairs in order, updated his will, making generous provisions for his family and servants, and even wrote a brief autobiography so candid and serene that one friend quipped it was the only cheerful piece of writing in that genre. As his health declined, visitors streamed to his bedside, among them the ever-curious James Boswell. Many came expecting, or perhaps hoping, to see fear or regret in the great skeptic at the end. Instead, they found Hume placid and even cheerful, joking about how death might be nothingness, a mere eternal rest, hardly something to dread. On an August day in 1776, David Hume passed away at age 65, attended by his doctor and a few friends. There was no deathbed conversion, no cries for mercy, just a quiet exit, as one might leave a pleasant gathering early because the hour grows late. Hume's funeral was simple, yet even in death he caused a stir. Rumors spread that lightning struck the graveyard the night after his burial, which some took as divine judgment on the infidel, though it was likely apocryphal. His tombstone, at his request, carried only his name and dates, with no pious epitaph. In the years and centuries that followed, Hume's ideas steadily gained the recognition they hadn't always received during his life. His philosophical skepticism became a foundation for modern empiricism and the scientific approach to understanding the mind. Immanuel Kant, arguably the central figure of modern philosophy, admitted that Hume interrupted my dogmatic slumber and drove him to develop his critical philosophy. In theology, Hume's arguments about miracles and the limits of human knowledge anticipated the secular, critical perspective that would blossom in the 19th and 20th centuries. And in the social sciences, Hume's insights into human psychology, as a creature more governed by sentiment and habit than by pure reason, prefigured modern psychology and economics. Adam Smith's theories of moral sentiments and market behavior were influenced by discussions with his friend, Hume. Perhaps equally important is the personal legacy Hume left in how to live a good life grounded in skepticism. He demonstrated by example that one could question religious and metaphysical certainties without falling into despair or nihilism. Hume's gentle, benevolent disposition was a rebuttal to those who claimed that without faith, a man must be wicked or despondent. Voltaire, upon hearing of Hume's peaceful death, remarked that the English had thought one couldn't be both a philosopher and a good person. But here is David Hume proving them wrong by his life and death. Today, David Hume is widely regarded as one of the greatest philosophers to write in English. His works remain staples in philosophy courses worldwide. Whenever scientists emphasize observation and experiment, they echo Hume. Whenever people debate whether reason or emotion drives human choices, they are walking the ground Hume cleared. He helped shift the center of philosophy from lofty speculation to the common human experience, from the heavens to the hearth, so to speak. In a churchyard in Edinburgh's Old Calton burial ground stands a stout cylindrical tomb where Hume's remains lie. Visitors often leave pennies on it, a nod, perhaps, to his portrait once gracing Scotland's currency, or maybe to his empirical, down-to-earth philosophy. Standing there, one can reflect on the journey of the farmer's son, who became a celebrated man of letters and changed the course of thought. David Hume approached truth with a light heart and keen mind. He showed the world that skepticism need not be a source of terror, that one can question and doubt and still live fully and kindly. And in that final meeting with Boswell, he even showed how a life guided by reason and virtue can meet death with a smile. As Hume himself wrote in his autobiography, he was a man of mild dispositions, of command of temper, of an open, social, and cheerful humor, who sought truth in all things. In the end, he found truth enough in the tranquility of a life well lived and a death well met, leaving behind a legacy of wisdom tempered by humanity.